The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
We light our chalice with this quote from Henry David Thoreau, which unfortunately did not include other genders, but still had the relevant message. If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Let him step to the music which he hears, however measured or far away.
And now we're lighting the peace lamp.
May peace be with us.
Hello, we're getting right to it today with our first speaker of three, Linda Stauffer. Linda has been involved with this fellowship, she tells me, since 1979 in some way or other, but she formally joined in 2010. And this is her first service that she's running, and I think it's an excellent topic, and we're going to hopefully learn more about being neurodivergent from three different perspectives, including the first one, Linda.
Hi, my name is Linda Stauffer, and I have ADHD. Can you hear me? I have ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. ADHD is also called ADD, but ADD is an outdated term. Currently, it is ADHD, regardless of whether or not the person shows hyperactivity. It is a disorder that is characterized by difficulty in maintaining attention and focus and includes struggles with executive function, emotional regulation, and inconsistent motivation and follow-through. The criteria also includes avoidance, procrastination, and time management challenges. It sometimes involves impulsive or hyperactive behavior, but not always. It often includes challenges with sensory processing. To call it just a disorder of attention is inaccurate and vastly oversimplifies the disorder. Russell Barkley, PhD, a prominent researcher and neuropsychologist, prefers a more descriptive term than ADHD. He suggests calling it executive dysfunction dysregulation disorder, or something like that. I didn't have time to verify that exactly. Dr. Barkley emphasizes it as largely a disorder of executive function rather than only of attention. ADHD presentations can change a lot from day to day and even hour to hour. ADHD is a neurodevelopmental disorder. It is not an intellectual disability. It is strongly inherited. It appears in childhood and can persist into adulthood. In the brain, it involves frontal lobe differences, which can be seen on brain imaging, such as MRIs. Trauma can make ADHD worse. We work to find ways to control our symptoms. We might be trying like hell to focus or to organize ourselves to function or to maintain our emotional composure. It can help to get specific therapy that addresses our challenges. Medications can improve functioning, but they are not perfect. ADHD is on a spectrum, so all people with ADHD are unique. Knowing one person with this disorder does not mean you know the characteristics of all individuals with it. Growing up with ADHD, I've had this disorder all my life, but it was not diagnosed until I was an adult. When I was tested by a neuropsychologist, he described it as a solid case. When I was in school, not much was known about the inattentive presentation of ADHD. My brother also had significant ADHD, the kind with hyperactivity, and he was diagnosed and treated as a child. He has suffered a lot with this disorder and still suffers. I just realized that I did not read the first part, which was all about neurodivergence, and I just dived right into the ADHD. So that's what happens. So I'll get to that. Yeah. Okay, so growing up with ADHD, I might as well continue, right? Okay, in school, I got by and I didn't cause much trouble. I was quiet, smart, and I got along with classmates. I would never lose my temper. However, I had many crying spells, many more than other kids. Report cards always noted that I needed to pay more attention. When I got in trouble for not paying attention, sometimes it was very distressing. One time, my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Evans, spoke to the class. Then she asked if everyone understood what she had said. She said to raise our hands if it was not clear. I raised my hand. Okay, Linda, what part of what I said did you not understand? Mrs. Evans said. Oh, the whole thing, I said. I could tell she was annoyed. So why do you think you didn't understand the whole thing? I said, Mrs. Evans. I guess things were going a little too fast for me, I said, trying to maintain some dignity. Okay, Linda, we'll discuss this later, but right now we have to line up for recess. Then Mrs. Evans said, now class, for Linda's benefit, since she feels things go too fast for her, I want you to all line up in slow motion. So they did. It was awkward for me to see them laughing and moving across the room in slow motion. I felt very alone. It hurt, especially since I had intended to pay attention in class, but I had done it again, not paid attention. The next day was Saturday. I climbed a tree near my home. As I sat in the tree, I saw my friends, Jay and Tor, two neighborhood boys who were in my class. Oh, look, there's Linda, said Tor. They both waved to me in slow motion. Then they ran in slow motion towards Jay's house. That hurt too. I didn't blame the kids for using slow motion. Mrs. Evans had told them to do that. At the time, I blamed myself. I had failed to pay attention again. It took many years to realize that Mrs. Evans had been entirely wrong to use the class to make fun of me. My ADHD causes me to struggle with inconsistent focus, challenges with executive function, poor short-term memory, and emotional dysregulation. Intermittently, I struggle with perceiving the concept of time, which may cause me to be late for things or to misjudge periods of time. Sometimes I struggle with motivational dysregulation. While we often struggle to focus, there are also times when we hyperfocus. This cannot be controlled. Sometimes hyperfocus can be great, such as when we're working on a creative project. Other times, hyperfocusing can interfere with what is expected of us in schools, jobs, or social situations. I hate that my ADHD is considered predominantly inattentive presentation. That makes it sound like a criticism, like the person is just not trying hard enough. Finding better terminology is one of my goals. I also have depression, social anxiety, most of which, I believe, is from trying to cope with ADHD and the effects it has had on my life. I have had some job successes, but also a great many disappointments with employment and social situations, and it's a struggle to keep my life organized. I've been chronically underemployed most of my working life. I had a brief career as a technical writer, which I loved and did well, but some things happened and I've been unable to get back to my career yet. In conversations, sometimes I can't remember what people said and I struggle to follow conversations that involve more than four people because there's too much sensory input. Understanding my own ADHD has helped alleviate my depression and anxiety. The more I understand it, the more I can develop techniques to cope. And I can forgive myself for a lot of things that are not my fault. Now I'm glad to see that there's more understanding of ADHD and is being studied a lot. I'm grateful and interested to hear the new developments. I'm glad if fewer kids will go through things caused by misunderstandings of their condition. Who has ADHD and who doesn't? Many people tell me they have always felt they have ADHD too. Of those who say this, a certain percentage of their self-assessments will be correct. Others are actually neurotypicals struggling with normal cognitive human challenges. I encourage anyone who thinks they may have this condition to get tested if they can. It is valuable for your own self-knowledge. Neuropsychologists do a series of tests to diagnose ADHD and to see if there might be anything else that could be causing the symptoms. This is called a differential diagnosis. Some people believe that having ADHD is just a different way of being and not a disorder. You can trust me, it's a disorder. I am well aware that everyone has focusing problems sometimes. When people say that they don't think we have ADHD because everyone has those challenges, it discounts our experiences of having a real disability. Please understand that ADHD is something other than a normal challenges. Yes, lacking focus is a normal part of being human, but ADHD is real. People with ADHD can be very successful despite the disorder. But sadly, very often, they are vastly underemployed and have many related difficulties and health problems that ADHD causes. Seeing people with highly successful careers who have ADHD can cause some people to come to their own conclusions. Not everyone can get where they want to go because ADHD can be extremely disabling. Hopefully, this will change as scientists discover more every day. A higher percentage of people with ADHD may engage in risky behavior. They are prone to accidents and substance abuse issues. Some physical problems are common, such as weight problems and cardiovascular issues. Emotional dysregulation, what I want people to know. I hope people will begin to understand my struggles with emotional regulation. Usually I'm calm, but sometimes I might get emotionally flooded about something and it can come on suddenly. I might start to cry and it can be extremely difficult to regain my composure. It could last a few minutes or a few hours, but not longer than that. Some friends know they can help by being very calm and talking with me or giving me space. When the emotional flooding happens, it passes and then I'm okay. When I have a meltdown, I might look like a mess, but I'm a lot stronger than I look. So friends can help by not getting too worried over it. Okay, I'm wrapping it up here. I want people to understand that people with ADHD can have many talents. My abilities are changeable and might be better or worse at different times. I want a chance to do things, and I hope you will understand if there are things I don't do as well sometimes. Famous people with ADHD: Michael Phelps, Justin Timberlake, Michael Jordan, Lisa Ling, James Carville. Conclusion: ADHD. We want to be understood and to be known for our abilities. We want to have pride and dignity. We want to succeed and to contribute. We want better futures for children with ADHD. I'm grateful to live in a time when neuroscientists are making so many advances in understanding ADHD. That helps so much. Thank you. And now I have to figure out where to fit in the short intro to the general theme of being neurodivergent, because I got it out of order. Should I just? Oh, okay. Should we just do, and then we can do that as a wrap up? Okay, that's a great idea. We're gonna now do the next. I am the last speaker, but no, we have the next speaker. I guess we would like to do is Teresa Adams, who is a member of our congregation, and we are welcoming her up here, and we'll be happy to see what she has to say.
Unfortunately, my journey with neurodivergence started on January 8, 1988. It was a very normal day. I was working the 12 to 8 shift as a physical therapist at Pottstown. Around 5 o'clock, I felt as if my eye was twitching. No one else could see it, so I just assumed, and I also had just a nagging headache. It was not the worst headache I ever had in my life. It was just there. Since it was a Friday night, our daughter Rosemary was at my brother's while my husband was bowling. On the way home from picking her up, I noticed I was losing my peripheral vision. I was afraid that something was really happening that was not good, so I went over to sit with my neighbors until Greg got home. By that time, my sight had come back. This is before they had the idea that it was a brain attack. That was not a thing back then, or I would have went to the hospital that night. So the next morning, I got up, went to my doctor, and he confirmed my suspicion that it was just a migraine. And I had just had a baby, migraines ran in my family, so he prescribed medication for it. That's the last thing I remember. When the headache didn't go away by Monday, I went back to the doctor. This time he looked into my eyes and could see that my eyes were bulging. This indicated there was some kind of blockage. In very quick order, I had a CAT scan and an MRI. These tests showed a blockage in the third ventricle, which was causing swelling and putting pressure on my optic nerve, which caused the vision loss. I was put on medication to decrease the swelling and advised to have surgery as soon as possible. We called very many different neurosurgeons all over the city, but no one could see me for at least 2 weeks. I knew tumors in that location. I should have died the night I had the headache, because if you block the third ventricle, you die. So after talking about it and discussing it, we decided to go with the local neurosurgeon who I knew and trusted very much. Surgery was scheduled for January 20th, 1988. During the surgery, the surgeon became aware that the tumor was much more involved than that showed on any of the scans. It was much bigger and had its own blood supply. It was in the corpus callosum, which is the memory center of the brain. My short-term memory was 30 seconds after my surgery. I was transferred to the brain injury unit at McGee Rehab. There, I underwent neuropsych testing. To this day, I still had no idea what was going on. I was disoriented to time and place. I had no memory of anything other than being told that I had a migraine. I told everyone that I was in a car accident. It was the only thing that made sense to me. Once at McGee, they did neuropsychological testing. The testing showed severe short-term memory loss. At the time, my short-term memory was only 30 seconds. Greg would be visiting me for an hour, go out and ask the nurse a question, and I would greet him as if I hadn't seen him that day when he came back in. I can only imagine how hard it had to be on him. At McGee, they made us very independent. We were responsible for asking for our own medications. We were responsible for getting to our own therapies. And we also had to get to the dining room on our own. A couple times, they sent a friend of mine that was in McGee at the same time as us. They sent us to the main dining room. We had our own special dining room on the brain injury floor. But they would send Val and I down to the main dining room. We always joked that if we got lost, someone would know where to put us back. In PT and OT, they mainly focused on my endurance. I was very lucky that I never, ever had any paralysis. I had a few balance issues, but they resolved fairly quickly. Speech was where most of my therapy occurred. They introduced me to my logbook. This is a book where I had to write down my schedule and anything I wanted to or needed to remember. I was an inpatient there for 6 weeks. I was then transferred to day hospital when I was discharged. I was in therapy for 3 days a week. In outpatient, they focused more on reintegrating to the community. So Greg would not have to drive into the city every day. They had me take the train with another therapist to Suburban Station. They also, during my therapy, they would take me up to Suburban Station, disorient me, and I would have to find my way out. Now, there was always a therapist following me, but I had never been in Suburban Station. in my life. I was a nice suburban girl. I didn't take public transportation. It was scary. After 5 weeks, the therapist that I was taking the train with went on vacation. My old OT told me that she was hearing wonderful things about how I was doing, but she wanted to see for herself. So she told me just to wait on my track, and her train got in 5 minutes after mine, and she would come and I could lead her in so she would know I was okay. Unfortunately, her train was 2 hours late that day. I did not know that. After waiting a half hour and realizing that I was going to miss my first therapy, I took off on my own. My therapist came in panic-stricken, thinking that I was roaming underground in suburban station and not being able to find my way out. Fortunately, I was able to find my way to McGee that day. I continued for outpatient for 6 months. They also had a community reentry program. Every week we would go a different place in Philadelphia. We were responsible for finding out how to get there, planning the SEPTA route, purchasing the tickets if needed, and if it was in walking distance, we had to plot the route on a map and find us and do it ourselves. I say that they were mean, but I was a PT, and I know that's the way they were making us very independent. We were also responsible for checking the weather and wearing appropriate clothing. Again, I was outpatient for 6 months. Due to the increased chance of seizures during brain surgery, I was on anti-seizure medication for 18 months. Once I finished therapy, I was a stay-at-home mom. Rosemary was only 18 months old. I had so many charts. I had diaper changing charts, bottle feeding charts, food charts, what she ate, so I didn't feed her the same thing every day. I had to set the timer when she went to preschool so I would remember to pick her up. It has been 37 years and my memory has improved, but I still suffer from short-term memory issues. In addition to the short-term memory issues, I feel when I awoke from the surgery, I was a different person. I was not the same person I was before. I had a lot of anger outbursts, again, due to the brain surgery. I was never able to return to my job as a physical therapist. So what I do is I fill my time, I volunteer, and I try to help people out as much as I can. I always will have the memory issues. And like I said, my surgery also caused problems controlling my emotions. I've become very labile. I can go from being calm and collected to a raging maniac within a matter of minutes. I do still continue to use all my compensation techniques. I hate having to depend on anyone else. So by using my compensating techniques, I feel I am able to become independent. So if you ask me to do something and I say I have to check my calendar, it's because I have no idea of what I have scheduled for whenever you ask me. So, and having, when I tell people I have memory issues, they say, oh, don't worry about it. I forget things all the time. It is so not like that. In my case, the memory never got into my brain. It never registered. So it's totally different. I don't like being this way. I wish I had never had the surgery. I mean, I'm glad I had the surgery because I lived, but I would not wish this on my worst enemy. So thank you for listening to me. I hope I explained a little bit about short-term memory loss. And so thank you very much.
Before we go to the last speaker who's in video, Linda, would you just like to come back shortly and just explain what being neurodivergent, what neurodivergence is? When working on the service with her, I found the symbol for neurodivergence, which is the mathematical symbol for affinity, but has the colors of the spectrum, Roy G. Biv, if you remember that from elementary school, on it. So Linda, would you...
Okay. This is generally on being neurodivergent. Thank you, Mike. This is brief. Neurodivergence means that a person's brain processes information in a way that is not typical. We all know people who are neurodivergent. There are many here today who might be. Our first UU principle states that we affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We will explore this principle from the perspective of being neurodivergent. Here are a few examples of neurodivergent conditions: ADHD, traumatic brain injury, Tourette syndrome, autism spectrum disorder, PTSD, dyslexia, and sensory processing disorder. There are many, many others. Some people are born with these conditions, others are acquired. Some neurodivergent people have challenges with reading and writing, social interaction and communication, coordination and motor skills, and learning differences. Some people struggle in their careers, education, and with relationships. There is some debate about whether some neurodivergent people have unusual abilities, such as strong pattern recognition, visual processing abilities, or creativity. This is controversial and is not proven. Some may have had these abilities independently of having neurodivergent condition. Others feel that the condition gives them their abilities. It will be interesting to see if neuroscientists make more discoveries about neurodivergence and creativity. It is true that each person is unique, even within each condition. Also, pursuing creativity can often help a neurodivergent person with confidence and expression. Having neurodivergent people in our communities brings diversity of thought. It brings new perspectives that we can use to solve problems. We want to be included and not shamed. We want to function as well as we can. These three views of being neurodivergent represent only a few of many conditions. You are hearing some of our histories, struggles, coping skills, disappointments, changes, wishes, and successes. Today's service is just an overview, and you may leave with more to think about.
Now we'll play a video of our last speaker, Stephen DeJoseph.
Hi, I'm Stephen DeJoseph, and it's a pleasure to speak to you guys today, even though it's through video. When I was 6 years old, two things happened for me. One is that I saw the Beatles perform on television for the first time in American soil, they say. And I was watching at my grandmother's house, and I jumped from the chair onto my feet, and I said, I have to do that. I want to do that. I need to do that. So it was this sudden burst of enthusiasm about becoming an artist, a creative person in the world of music. And the second thing that happened almost simultaneously was that I began to have these urges and make these strange noises and blurt curse language. All these things began to manifest at the same time, the music and what eventually I found out was Tourette's syndrome. So my neurodiverse platform is from Tourette's and the things that fall under the umbrella of Tourette's, which is things like OCD, versions of ADD, organizational challenges, a number of aspects. Tourette's is a syndrome, so it has a number of components to it. They call comorbids. So that said, these are my roots. And so for 10 years, I didn't know what it was. We didn't know what it was called. We thought, well, you know, he's into music and maybe he's just weird. You know, he's just strange. He's just got behaviors that seem to go with that or something. So that went on for about 10 years till I was 16 years old. And then we finally heard the diagnosis, the words, Tourette's syndrome. So I spent the last 60 years living with Tourette's. And part of what eventually this journey led me to was to make a film about it. And specifically about the 10 years during the time I had no label for what was going on. I started to, I just figured, like I said, part of being a musician, part of the creative force. And it turns out that I was not far from accurate in that sense. So when I started to explore the idea of making this film, I began to discover people with neurodiverse conditions in on the spectrum, ADHD, ADD, OCD, Asperger, clear into autism. I found that almost invariably there was a heightened creative drive, a creative force, if you will, that would just manifest itself in some way, shape, or form. It didn't have to be music or theater, or it could be anything, mathematics, gardening, authorship, so many different aspects, the way someone excels at work. There are people all across the board with neurodiverse conditions. So it became evident to me that it was very important to discuss this condition, not just from a medical standpoint, not just from a challenge standpoint, but from the actual contributions that are manifested through these conditions. There was a film called The Tic Code, and it focused around a young child who had Tourette's and an uncle who also had Tourette's but didn't really admit it. The uncle eventually started to encourage the kid to say, well, this is like a superpower. You know, this is like, this gives you the ability to explore realms that maybe other people can't. The idea was that it gave the kid a sense of value with his condition, because it obviously, conditions of this sort make you feel odd. You feel outside of what is normal. However, We know more now today than ever that the word normal has morphed and stretched and twisted and become a different meaning. So I developed an idea called A Synaptic Adventure, Tourette's and Beyond. Tourette's, of course, because that's my platform. Beyond, because it's a universal story. It's a story of discovery, adaptation, and determination. And those were the elements that have driven me in my own career as a recording artist, a performing artist. I've played nearly 8,000 concerts and performances in my career, pretty much almost 55 years of multiple recordings and video productions. And the most recent is that I got a record deal and an international record release. So things happen for people in all walks of life, you know. It does. Sometimes it's just, it's more circuitous maybe, or appears to be more circuitous, but I would liken it to the nature of water, and how water is mutable and moves in and out and around and under the things it comes across. And so I would say that these are important elements to keep in mind when you're thinking about neurodiversity and wanting to understand it more. Thanks for listening. My website, please visit it, www.stephendijoseph.com, StephenDijoseph. Thanks so much for listening.
The first thing I have to say is thank you. And thank you. and to Stephen also. Thank you. My role here today is to introduce matters of the heart, which those of you who are regularly here understand and expect. It's one of the reasons we gather as a community is to share our life stories, our important experiences. I'm going to take advantage of being up here to say a few things on this topic myself, and one of the reasons I am grateful for your saying the things you have. I myself am dyslexic, modestly so, and is also one of my granddaughters, and her life experience has been so different from mine because of the work of neuroscientists and educators. Her disorder, I guess we can call it, her divergence, was recognized early in her school career. There were techniques she was taught. There were devices that improved her life. There are special fonts that help dyslexics succeed at reading and things like that. Things that were not once available are now, and it has changed life experiences for so many. The granddaughter and her sister are both ADHD diagnosed with different manifestations in each case. One of them is also on the autism spectrum. The experience of these people is so much better than it would have been decades ago. There is a ways to go. We know that. There are societal expectations that these people don't necessarily meet, but they're more accepted now than ever before. But back to my primary role, which is to invite you to share both your response to today's discussions and to share anything that is going on in your life, whether it is a source of joy or of sadness, that you would like the community to welcome and respond to. You can come on up, say who you are, more briefly than I did, share with us, and then our technical people will help those who are here by Zoom or with their phones to share also if they wish.
We can bring this time of sharing to a close, and as with many times, we will sing Spirit of Life. The words and video will appear on the screen here momentarily.
Oh, I now invite you to sing with me Spirit of Life.
Bruce Southworth. We pause this hour to honor the spirit and to accept ourselves as fragile humans, equally full of nobility and strength. We gather weary of life's trials, yet cheered by infinite possibilities of love's grace. We meet with smiles and glad voices for old friends and new, every stranger a gift of potential friendship. We rejoice in the keen intellect and warm heart. We remember those whose opportunities and needs our society thwarts, and we give thanks for the blessings that are ours. We praise all who extend a hand in service and whose vision of justice commands actions. We pause. We gather. We meet. We rejoice. We give thanks. We praise. We proclaim our community.
Nicole will extinguish the chalice.
We extinguish our chalice, but not the light of truth, the warmth of compassion, and the flame of liberty and justice. These we hold within us, take with us into the world to share with those whose lives we touch, whose lives touch our own.
In conclusion to being neurodivergent, thank you for listening to some views of being neurodivergent. I hope this gives you some things to think about, especially concerning the individuality of each neurodivergent person and our inherent worth and dignity. And the closing song is done by Stephen DeJoseph. It's called Etude with Tourette Attitude. Hope you enjoy that.
And so this kind of Chopin goes Latin.
Well, not right away. Okay, it's Polish.
Thank you. riding on a runaway train. Engineers are lost. Got a fuzzy feeling in my brain. Sound tossed. I don't remember boarding this train. We'll pay the cost. People looking at me like I'm crazy. I just throw it away. Sauced. In the thick of it, not a little bit, make me sense of it. My unruly brain, unruly brain, so unruly, so unruly, so unruly, yeah, 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 yeah. They tell me it's a disgrace. I tell them I'm too busy to concern myself with leaving this place. I feel so likely I'm a time traveler running through space. People looking at me like I'm crazy, close to the place of songs. Totally. In the thick of it. Not a little bit, make no sense of it.
All right, Zoom folks who are left with us, thank you for joining us today. We're going to go ahead and wind things down. I hope you all have a wonderful week, and we'll hopefully see you next Sunday.